Jacques Cousteau's book, there's this moment, this sort of the turning point of his book. He was an officer in, I think, the Navy, and he looked under the water, and it was a completely different world. And then he looked back up and saw people just milling around, no idea what was under the surface. People who could like dive into topics that are kind of unfathomable, I mean, beyond comprehension, and able to put them into words that we can understand.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm a psychoanalyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guest today is Dr. Chris Heath. Dr. Heath is a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst in private practice in Dallas, Texas. Dr. Heath has dedicated himself to helping people understand their unconscious mind, and he's done this through his remarkable YouTube channel called Heath MD. It's one word, H-E-A-T-H-M-D, which, for those of you who will follow it, features really remarkably entertaining videos about how our minds work, and it has 45,000 views. Dr. Heath is a member of the Social Media Editorial Board of the International Psychoanalytic Association, and he's a member of the Committee for Public Information of the American Psychoanalytic Association. As you can hear in our interview today, there's an aliveness and a vibrancy to Dr. Heath. He shows all of us his love of the work, his love of explaining the work, and the gift he has for taking really very nuanced concepts and presenting them in very user-friendly fashion. I hope you enjoy our talk today. Chris, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor. Thanks, Harvey.
The videotapes you make about psychoanalytic concepts for YouTube are so particular. They're so personable and idiosyncratic. They're so you. That I thought that the best way we could introduce the topic to our listeners is to play a clip. So I'm going to start us off by playing the audio of 1 minute from your video, How Does Psychotherapy Work? Here we go.
Psychotherapy works, but there's a mysterious process to it. Heath MD here, psychoanalyst for Freud Alicious Mind. Explore the depths of your unconscious and find yourself. There's a lot of different kinds of therapies, but there's something in common with all of them. When they work, there's a certain thing that happens. There's this thing where we have these repeating patterns in our life. Maybe you always feel inferior. You always feel superior. Maybe you always get overwhelmed by emotion. Or maybe you don't feel the emotion at all. And when therapy works, that pattern gets played out with the therapist in a way you don't expect. The therapist doesn't actually expect it. There's a surprise to it. And that's the mystery of psychotherapy. Because these patterns that get played out all the time in your life, they get played out in the space of the psychotherapist's office, a mysterious space.
Now, what the listening audience can't appreciate, though might be able to imagine, is as dramatic as the audio was, the visual is at least as dramatic. There are change in costumes, there's change in hairstyle, you use brightly colored graphs, there are change in sets. It's really quite eye-catching. It actually reminded me, and I don't know if this was on your mind, about of Sesame Street in the stimuli to engage the audience. Tell us about this project of yours. It's so particular. Where did it come from in your mind? What did you set out to do? What led you to adopt this particular style? And what kind of outcomes have you seen in terms of responses from people, those you've expected to hear from, those who you haven't? Walk us through, if you will, this piece of your professional life.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up Sesame Street. I watched Sesame Street as growing up, maybe everybody did. And I continue to be surprised by where these videos come from within me, you know, because the creative process engages the unconscious in a way that, I mean, if you could figure it out, it wouldn't be creative, right? It wouldn't be a discovery. You know, I had no idea I'd make videos. I mean, that was the last thing on my mind. I was, I'm a psychoanalyst, and through my training analysis, required for training as a psychoanalyst, I discovered amazing things about myself. I mean, I'm a different person after my psychoanalysis than I was before. And I see the same thing in patients. I mean, whether they're in, you know, once, twice, three times a week psychotherapy or full psychoanalysis, people change. They discover things about themselves. And it's profound, and it helps them. It helps their families. It helps the community. So I'm a psychiatrist, and I'll tell people that I can do therapy with them, and they're shocked that a psychiatrist even does therapy. And people, I don't know if you've been actually laughed at, but I've been smirked at least about bringing up the couch and that we still use that and, free associations, and that I just listen and create space. And so there's this community, this absence in the community of an awareness of, I think that we even exist, much less that we are available to help people. And so that's the contrast, the kind of conflict that I've been working all this time to try to resolve.
And just so I know what you mean, the conflict between the exquisite privacy of a real analytic process and encounter. And the problem of that privacy is that, but for the handful of people involved and their family and friends, it's not known more widely that we exist and we can offer people profound life changes.
Absolutely. Yeah. The contrast between the privacy and how do we outreach, but also the contrast between a couple of contrasts. I love this between the depth of meaning that you can arrive at when you really listen and you really listen inside as well as to a person. And the quick fix kind of culture that we have, where it's much more about what can we buy the family for Christmas, or just take Prozac and you'll feel better. And there's roles for those things. I mean, medications are helpful and life-saving even, but there's kind of an absence of an approach to meaning. I think culture is beginning to get there with mindfulness, meditation, and some spiritual pursuits, but there's still contrast. I think there was survey that the International Psychoanalytical Association did 2 or 3 years back, where they did focus groups around the world, where they sat some people down, both analysts and potential patients, and asked them what they think about psychoanalysis. And there's everyone, it was like a continuity of responses that everyone was afraid of psychoanalysis. The task force that did this study called it the swallowing hole, a term that they apply to both analysts and potential patients. Potential patients are afraid of that the analyst won't be able to tolerate the feelings, the depth of stuff the patient brings into the room. And analysts, both candidates and established analysts, have similar kinds of fears, but their fears tend to be manifested in having to be stuck in, part of it, stuck in the homogeneity of psychoanalytic, you know, there's a caricature of psychoanalysis where we all are just a blank slate and we all do the very same thing. And there's something about that analysts in these focus groups were afraid of breaking free from, even though, in fact, you and I both know that psychoanalysis as practiced by a practitioner is a very individual thing. We have to listen to ourselves. And so what is it? How do you do that? You know, so there's a fear. I think there's multiple levels to the conflict between that keeps us psychoanalysts from being able to get out in the community and let people know in a way that the community can hear, you know?
What strikes me about listening to your videos is that there has a cartoonish quality. And yet, if one really listens, the concepts that you're bringing forward are very nuanced and at times profound. Just that one little clip we listened to, you really spoke about transference and enactments and unconscious repetition all in that 1 minute and all with a lot of bells and whistles, but you did get the message across nicely. And I assume that's obviously intentional. How did you come to the style that you've used in these videos?
It's kind of an unconscious thing in part. I put a lot of thought into, sometimes I'll start thinking about a video by thinking about a paper, a psychoanalytic paper that I've read, or a theoretic construct like Klein's ideas of splitting and projective identification. And how do you make a video about that? It's kind of a challenge to myself sometimes. And you know, I mean, a lot of factors. Part of it is Jerry Lewis is a psychoanalyst here in Dallas who used to say that if you can explain it to your neighbor who's not an analyst, you understand it, you know. So that's part of it. But I think a lot of it's just intuitive. As I'm reading a paper and trying to understand a concept, sometimes I'll think about the person I have to explain it to. And another thought, as we're talking, when I was a medical student, before I decided I was barely thinking about becoming a psychiatrist, much less a psychoanalyst, I figured I'd be an internal medicine specialist. But my psychiatry rotation, there was this Dr. Cunaro, I don't even know her first name, down in San Antonio, used to tell me that you can understand love and hate. And one of these days, she said, she'd sit down with me and she'd draw it out for me. And she was talking about splitting mechanisms where we project some of what we don't like about ourselves onto the other person. And she did. The last day of the rotation, she was headed out the door, and I could tell she was in a hurry, and I was too, but I begged her. And so she sat down with me, and in a 90-second period, she drew out, I don't know if you've seen Kernberg's kind of division of the self and object, and she drew all that in the aggressive drive derivative and the libidinal drive derivative, good object and the bad object, in other words. And so I got that book of Kernberg's and read it, and that's how I became a psychoanalyst, basically.
And yet, when I look at the names of your videotapes, the last thing they are is technical sounding. Some of them are remembering, what is that? Another is, what is creepy? Another is, why we like scary stuff? Another one is on awe. Another on telepathy. And my favorite title is Surrender. What does that even mean? Even just the titles of them show how you're able to take what might be metapsychology, but really speak to your neighbor about it in English, which, as you say, shows that you really understand it. Who is your audience for this? And has it turned out that who you expected to be interested is, in fact, who is interested? What have you learned from your analytics?
Multiple dimensions to the answer to that, but my main population, my audience, ends up being 25 to 35 year olds, evenly distributed between the two genders, which is interesting. A lot of sciencey type video YouTube channels have mostly males that watch them, and so people, when I go to YouTuber conferences, people are kind of envious of, you know, hey, how do you do that? One of the ways I found my way to making videos, I think the simplicity of my titles is kind of embedded in this, is that I was trying to figure out a way to engage the greater community. And I was chair of the outreach committee here at the local institute. But it's the same people that come over and over again to conferences. It's never like the college-age kid who doesn't know how to ask somebody out, or like a 35-year-old that is in a dead-end job that's starting to drink too much. It's never the people that could really use kind of insight. And so I kind of gave up on that and started trying to find something sort of to embed myself in the community. I started educating actually in economics, because I think that's kind of the religion of our capitalist society, like keeping up with the Joneses. I mean, it's kind of woven into us. And so I was taking all these classes, and I took this class in game theory. And game theory is really amazing because it's a very sophisticated concept, but I needed to relearn calculus. I had taken calculus a long time ago and barely understood it. And I found, and here's the key, I found this class online by Jim Fowler. I still remember his name at the Ohio State University, a video class on calculus. And he could explain it with a combination of words and visuals, like concepts like infinity and how do you make the fraction 1/infinity, these like abstract things. And so I started realizing that, you know, if he can do that with calculus, maybe I can do that with psychoanalysis. And there's a lot of examples of this. And so I started thinking about Bill Nye and how Bill Nye is a physicist who began to make videos about how science works. And he does this. He puts it into funny costumes like I do and talks about the speed of light or, you know, weather. And Jacques Cousteau actually also, in Jacques Cousteau's book, there's this moment that's sort of the turning point of his book. He was officer in, I think, the Navy, and he was a career military, but he was swimming with some friends. And this pal of his had a diving mask where you can see under the water, like a scuba mask, back before scuba, you know. And he looked under the water and it was a completely different world. And then he looked back up and saw people just milling around, no idea what was under the surface. I think it's maybe Sesame Street, for sure Bill Nye and Jacques Cousteau, and people who could like dive into topics that are kind of unfathomable, I mean, beyond comprehension, but able to put them into words that we can understand. So I've spent a lot of time with YouTuber conferences and friends I've made that do video marketing. And it's all about being simplistic enough to grab your audience, but complex enough to get them interested. And so I've spent a lot of time kind of honing that. And part of that's, for me, silliness. So yeah, like you say, I've got an Einstein outfit. I've got a French artist outfit. I work with a green screen so I can put anything back there, you know?
Well, that image really captivated me of the of going beneath the surface of the water. And like you say, the people on land don't know what's happening and don't know what they're missing. And it matches. At times, I'm sitting in my office with a patient and feel moved by the privilege of being immersed in someone's underwater world, not to mention being able to help them get a feel for it and have their life affected by that access to that piece of themselves. So there's something that you capture in the description, and it also matches my experience of, like I said, of listening to your videos where they seem simple, but indeed they're not. And I think that's why they reach the people they do.
I actually have a lot of anxiety about that. That's one of my biggest sources of anxiety, oddly. And this reflects the finding of the International Psychoanalytical Association study groups, because I have a little bit of anxiety about public speaking. I've kind of gotten used to it. I'm good with it now. And some anxiety, I think we all share this as psychoanalysts, about, you know, what's the effect of this newfound presence in the community on our patients. But the biggest source of anxiety is irrational. The biggest source of anxiety is that one of these days, I'm going to put a video together. And sometimes the natural vision between ideas is different than the artificial division between theoretic concepts in the psychoanalytic field. And so sometimes, like, I can think of a video in particular where I talk about both Kleinian ideas of splitting and very primitive dynamics and Cohutian ideas of merger and reflection. And one of these days, there's going to be somebody that says, oh, those theories don't match, you know, and get on to me about it. I've got nothing but positive feedback from the psychoanalytic community. It's been really rewarding and terrific.
Let me share with you, I'm intrigued by what you say, because my immediate take is if somebody should get on you for being what they would declare theoretically imprecise or inaccurate, I have heard that concern from a number of people that I've interviewed who are working off the couch, loosely said, where they have a superego that is represented through some supervisor or somebody who they still feel and these are senior people who are doing at times remarkable work, they still feel, uh-oh, I'm doing it wrong. And my reaction is the people who they have in their mind, and people believe it's an other as opposed to in our own head, they're not doing this work. So for this fictional person who you picture is going to critique you, I can guarantee you they're not making videos and they're not reaching the numbers of people you're reaching, which disqualifies them in my mind of really making a comment. You know, let them make a video that they think is more theoretically perfect and see how many people it reaches. That's exactly the problem that your work is a remedy for. It's making outreach. It's not being theoretically perfect.
I so appreciate that. And yes, it's probably not that supervisor or that supervisor's supervisor that is the truth of who's criticizing me. It's more my superego kind of gone wild. But there it is. And it's a kind of a common thing. So the viewers, it's true. You know, I did outreach for a long time. I worked with people that were also doing outreach here in the city I practice in. And if you got 10 or 20 people at a event, it'd be good, you know. And it was usually the same people, and it's usually, you know, kind of your age people. But one of my target audiences, so I reached the 25 to 35 year old audience, and that's fine. Whoever watches it is good with me. What I was actually targeting was kind of the Bill Nye style audience, and under 18 was kind of my target. And I published this actually in the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association Journal about a year ago. This is one of my references in that list.
Yes, it's in the notes that are accompanying the podcast.
Good, but in that paper I talk about there's a category 18 to 24 year olds. So over a 15-month period is what I was doing using for metrics for this paper. And I think it was like 22,000 views I got in the 15 months. And in that 18 to 24-year-old group, I had 1,166 views. Now, if you think about having an event where there's 1,100, you know, 20-year-olds, oh my God, you know, you would, I would be ecstatic to have a tenth of that. And so I'm really reaching a big audience. I'm really amazed with these videos.
And you mentioned that you also, people write into you.
I love that part of it. You know, it's so hard because you make these videos and you post them and—
Yeah, you don't know what happens next. It's the same thing with the podcast, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. I figure you and I are in the same kind of boat with a lot of this stuff. And uh-huh. So you get some views. Sometimes you can find out like how long they stuck with the recording or the video. But beyond that, you know, did they like it? Did they hate it? My original goal was to get people at least comfortable with themselves and optimally to get the word out that psychoanalysts and psychoanalytic psychotherapists are available to help if you can't figure it out yourself. But even that, you know, I was careful not to promote locally. I was really careful. I mean, I talked with some friends locally, but mostly I tried to outreach through YouTube, some nationally, so that I could get a broader kind of scope. But that ends you up with getting no feedback until you start looking at YouTube. And YouTube, I didn't realize, you know, I thought YouTube was like Vimeo, where you post your video and it's just a platform for postings, but it can be that. But if you open up comments on YouTube, it becomes a social media. It becomes just like Facebook, where you post something and you get comments and you can comment back. And so, yeah, that has become the most gratifying thing because I get all kinds of comments and it's usually the best ones. Some of them are like I have a video about boredom and somebody jokingly said, hey, that was boring. Watch this out of boredom, he said, you know, and I replied back. But some of them are really moving. Jicama Juice. I don't know his real name, his or her. I love that awe inspires awe, he or she says after watching my video on awe. It's kind of like when you're in a good mood, you notice more of the wonderful. Things you might not have noticed if you were not looking for the good in things. I'm going to try to find some awe this weekend, he says. And I reply back. But a better one was Made by Ruben is the user's name. I don't know which video he was watching, but in the video I say, and he quotes, don't go back to sleep, so relevant to my life, but I'm afraid of being fully awake. And so he and I go back and forth, and I recommend that he see a therapist, and he is seeing a therapist, but he's been afraid to tell his therapist that this, that he feels asleep and he doesn't know what to do with it. And he doesn't get back with me about the outcome, but he seems in his comments more motivated to talk with his therapist about this. I find it really heartwarming and reassuring that I'm making a difference in people's lives as reflected by these comments.
That's lovely. Chris, we all come to what we do for a host of reasons. You made an analogy between your project and this podcast project, and there is an exhibitionistic quality in what we do that we have to acknowledge, certainly. Can you share something about you, your past, and what brings you to this expression of you and your past?
It's funny because I have told friends that I'm an extrovert stuck in an introvert's psyche. It's the conflict and different kind of conflict, I guess, but maybe embodied in the conflict I was talking about earlier about, you know, outreaching or do you outreach and the conflict about that. But in thinking about this, if you watch my video on rapprochement, is the name of my video about how I became an analyst. Some of this is in that I grew up, my grandfather pretty much raised me. And my grandfather, every holiday, had back in the day when video cameras were film, you know, a little 8mm film camera that he'd come around and film everything. And so I knew that film was available. I wasn't a movie buff until later, or a video buff until later on. But he was also a geologist. And geologists, they're scientists. It's kind of like architects, where they're scientists, but they're also aware of the what's under the surface. And he'd talk about, you know, back in the day, back in the 70s, you know, how do you find oil or water under the surface? You've got a little bit of data, but nothing like we have now. And so it's kind of mysterious. And between that and even with the structure of crystals, if you look at a crystal, you see it's got a shape, and that shape reflects the molecular structure. It reflects the internal structure of the crystal. And so you see it. It's just like acting out. Like, for instance, if I'm road raging, if I'm angry at the guy that just cut me off, and it's really an expression of that I was probably mad about something else and had been carrying it around, and here it kind of boils over. And that's what crystals are like too. So this awareness of what's under the surface, and kind of, you know, idealizing him, idealizing other leaders, my priest that I grew up with, the family physician that I grew up around, who always kind of had the answers and could guide you. So that's in me. But then the other side of it, where, and I'm not going to name names, but there was a kind of a dramatic element in my family growing up, and
I had a hunch.
And some of them, and if family, if you're listening, you know who you are. So you know, to incorporate that, and to incorporate the sort of the earthy solidity of my grandfather, the geologist, that kind of held the dramatic overreacting qualities of the family together. And to be honest, so this is in the video too, my grandfather dies when I'm 13, and which was a really hard time. I mean, it's for so many reasons, so many levels. But the big thing, one of the big things, was that stability was gone. And so I also saw what happens, you know, when there's just kind of overreactions and drama. And so I am one with seeing, you know, both the dramatic and the stability, the stabilizing forces. And I think, those are the two things that are in me. You know, I'm a doctor, now psychiatrist, now psychoanalyst. I like to help people figure themselves out and use my knowledge to help people. But at the same time, I can do these videos and kind of cut loose with, you know, dressing up. You've seen some of my videos where I'll dress up as Einstein. And even I worked for a while on that Viennese accent. It's awful, but I have fun with it, right? Mm-hmm. That's the important part.
Well, I want to thank you, Chris. Thank you for your work, certainly. Thank you for sharing yourself with me on this podcast. And I also want to close by encouraging our listeners to watch, listen and watch your video. It's on YouTube, HEATHMD, one word, It's really a delightful surprise. Share it with your friends. Share it with your children, your college-age children, your parents. And listen to it more than once, because there's a great deal in these. And the style is to invite you in. And it does succeed in offering, like you say, both the geologic solidity and the drama in a lovely fashion. So thank you so much for your work. I'm very grateful.
I have heartfelt thanks for what you just said. I appreciate your having me on the show, Harvey.
Great. My pleasure. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.